Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On the way to the segment, I will remind you the Mark Steiner Show, let me get to that, is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We're going to have a roundtable here this hour, looking at a number of issues facing Baltimore, the election, almost a year to the day when Freddie Gray was passed away. How Baltimore's changed, where we want to take it. Well, by a very unique group of people we love having in the house here. DeMonte Brown is here with us. She's director of Out for Justice, an ex-offender-led membership-based organization advocating for the reform of policies that adversely affects returning citizens from reentering our society. DeMonte, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Nicole Hansen's with us. She's board president of Out for Justice. Good to have you here, Nicole.
Thank you.
John Comer's with us, lead organizer for Maryland Communities United. In a moment, Dr. Lawrence Brown's here with us, and you at 410-319-8888. Good to have you on the studio.
Glad to be here.
So let me begin with one thing that came up at the mayor's forum that we did with you, John Comer, and Out for Justice over at Douglas Memorial Church. A number of people came up to me with these letters that they had received from the State Board of Elections saying that these were returning citizens who are on parole and probation, saying they were not allowed to vote, that all of a sudden that there was no record of them actually being out or some – I couldn't quite understand what the letter was saying. It was kind of crazy. And they were part of your organization, DeMonte. Some people came up. So can you give us a – understanding what's happening here?
Certainly. Well, I was at work and Dwayne, one of my members, comes and tells me that he received this letter stating that he's disqualified to vote because of his felony conviction. And based on, you know, what we do in Out for Justice, which is always advocating, we immediately got on the phone, called the Board of Elections. We started at the state level of unfortunately, Maryland State Board of Elections did not know anything about the letter, could not help us. So then we were brought to Baltimore City Board of Elections, and we spoke directly to Ms. Tracy Chapman after several waiting on hold. And then Ms. Chapman informed Dwayne that he received that letter because although Dwayne was released in 2013, his maximum release date said 2018. So when you get released from prison, you have a mandatory release date and a maximum release date. Dwayne's mandatory release date was 2013. He's been out for 3 years already.
Right. I talked to him there.
Exactly. Right. Everyone sees him, talks to him. But for some reason, the Board of Elections told him he would have to use a provisional ballot and present his release papers and or ID when he got to the Board of Elections. We took that up to Delegate McCray. As well as Marcus Dent, and they took things from there. And then, of course, Communities United had a whole effort going for all of the other people experiencing this issue. And Dwayne actually called me this morning and let me know that he's now active. He does not have to do a provisional ballot.
But that's the whole thing just sounded to me, John Comer, to be completely insane. I mean, but the law passed was that if you are on parole or probation for a felony and now a free person working in this society, paying taxes, that you get to vote.
Yeah, like to me, it sounds like a breakdown in the flow chart, the communication between the agencies. The bothersome part about it is for the newly enfranchised voters, they may look at it as another way to try to keep them from voting. And so it may discourage a good amount of people out here that are looking to be re-enfranchised.
Because we're talking about that's voter suppression, because this is a whole week between now and Thursday. If you're not registered to vote, you can register at early voting and vote. Am I right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's right. So we have 20,000 people in this city who have been convicted of a felony, who are free men and women on parole or probation, who have the right to vote.
No restrictions.
And can vote with no restrictions. And so this, in some ways, is a way to, it's like almost like voter suppression in a sense, because people are psychological.
Almost.
That means, because I can't, we say, well, wait a second, Nicole. But it's, you know, to say to somebody, well, maybe I can't vote then because I've got this letter.
Well, you know, it's also bothersome that, you know, the word wasn't spread by a government agency that now, not just, you know, people with felonies who are on probation and parole can vote, but just, you know, previously other ex-felons. Like, you know, we need to know that people have their rights restored. And, you know, it shouldn't be a nonprofit organization that has to do a press conference and get out the word on the ground that, you know, something that is pretty much controlled by government who have now restored their rights. You know, there should be letters that go out to everyone. Mm-hmm. They should do their own press conference. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they've kind of left it up to the people on the ground with the little resources that we have to try to cover the entire city of Baltimore as well as the state of Maryland. So.
And I truly expected that the Baltimore Central Committee would come out and do the work that they do. I really thought after attending a Baltimore Central Committee meeting that they were going to, you know, create some literature and they were going to come out in full force and let the people know about these voting rights laws and, you know, really organizing people to get out to vote.
Well, it's good to see you. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Good to have you in the house. You have any thoughts on this before we move on?
Well, I mean, I just think that I agree with Nicole. You know, I'm looking at the Democrats in Baltimore, and I think we ought to be clear. You know, Baltimore Democrats have gotten us in the situation that we're in, and so I think they're part of this situation as well, where, you know, there's much more that could be done to mobilize newly enfranchised voters, and they just weren't up to the task.
So, I you know, we're approaching the anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray. It's tomorrow. Many of you, at least three of you here so far, have been on the show before. And Lawrence, you've been on the show lots of times over the last several years. I just want to reflect on where we are this year later. This No Boundaries report came out, which I thought, as I said to the commissioner last hour, was, I think, one of the most profound reports to come out in a long time about people's perceptions and realities of their dealings with the Baltimore City Police. I mean, it was stunningly good, very powerful, as I keep saying it. It just showed the nature of the verbal abuse and physical abuse people are confronted with every day in the community, and I think that's why it was so important. But so where do you think we are after this year that clearly shook the city up and is shaking leadership up? But what changes do you see happening, and where do you think we're going since that day when we learned that Freddie Gray had passed away after we saw the video of him being arrested where he could barely even walk into that van?
Well, I think there are good things and bad things happening. The good things that are happening is that it's been an awakening that we need to work together. And there's been a lot more visible collaboration between grassroots organizations. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that type of collaboration between grassroots organizations, big corporations, and government, though. And unfortunately, another bad thing that I see that's happening is that a lot of people are capitalizing off of the death of Freddie Gray.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, T-shirts are being sold, rallies, protests are being held. And when I ask people, well, have you spoken to the family? Did they give you this blessing? You know, are they a part of this? That response is usually a no. And, you know, my sister was murdered, and I can only imagine always having to look up and seeing her name on someone's T-shirt or march without my permission. And so in one way, Freddie has been a catalyst for a lot of things, the great things that are happening in Baltimore. But I think we could do a much better job of honoring his family and honoring the legacy that he started for us in Baltimore versus making money or making movements or creating organizations based off of his death.
One part of the legacy of Freddie Gray that stands out to me is that he was lead poisoned. as was his entire family. And we just had in Annapolis most of the lead poison legislation shot down. I believe the only thing they passed was the ability to take the lead settlements to courts because there was so much exploitation there before. But since 1993, we've had 37,500 children in Baltimore poisoned by lead.
Since what year?
Since 1993. 37,500 children, and the vast majority of them are probably black. And I think that for us not to pass strong anti-lead poison legislation is a part of the greatest negligence and criminal activity among all of our elected officials to not do that swiftly, because how the way in which lead is a poison to the brain of our children, undermining their brain's development, and leading up to some of the activities that Freddie Gray was involved in, even that decision to run from the police, we know that lead inhibits your ability to control your emotions. And so maybe another person without lead poisoning would have said, I'm just going to stay in here, and the police would have passed on by. So lead poison, I think, is something that we haven't honed in on that. We've let the landlord lobby get away from it. And there are thousands more children who've been poisoned like Freddie Gray, and we're not doing enough to catch that poison and stop it.
So what would that mean, before I turn to this other side of the room here, what would that mean? I mean, to do something about it. I mean, I ask that question because for the last 23 years I've been asking, let's say, the CEOs of our public city school system. We have thousands of children who have been poisoned and damaged by lead. And we're worrying about these test scores, but you can't figure out what kind of test scores children can get to figure out how to handle the children who have been poisoned by lead and what's that done to their cognitive abilities. So what do we do for them and about them and with them? I mean, that to me is...
Right. I think the first, just start off declaring a state of emergency like Flint. Flint is in a state of emergency because of lead water. Baltimore is in a state of emergency because of mostly lead paint, but also lead pipes and lead water and lead poison water in our schools. So I think, you know, we have to, I think, when we think about the legacy of Freddie Gray, also consider how he was lead poisoned and how we're ignoring the very thing that proved to be such a toxin in his life with thousands and thousands of other children in this city.
And I also think that we have to mobilize, educate, and organize the directly impacted and people on the ground to support policymakers. A lot of times we just think that policymakers can wave a magic wand and something's going to happen. But a lot of bills die in the city council and in Annapolis because there's no support from the community behind those bills. There has not been any, I haven't seen a lot of education mobilizing the masses behind getting anti-lead paint poisoning passed. And, you know, if we think it's something that policymakers can just do on their own, then we are sadly mistaken.
And I think kudos to Delegate Jill Carter for pushing for that kind of legislation. And I think you're right. You know, we don't support her enough.
Right.
Thoughts on this? We have a tweet came in and said from Reality Bites that said Baltimore City Public Schools poisoned our children, but Baltimore legislation keeps ignoring it. The water was cut off in 2003.
Yes.
Right.
It was cut off at 03. So if I can just kind of divert the conversation, because, you know, while we can talk about all of the great challenges and the things that we see that are not changing, what I see that has changed, and it's a personal experience, is that those organizations who we talk about benefiting from this Freddie Gray uprising, they are organizations who are willing to invest in a very vulnerable population, vulnerable but yet ambitious group of people. And I say that because I am currently running a pilot reentry mentorship program. We have a lot of mentorship programs for young people, but not enough for adults returning into our communities. And I'm working with Strong City Baltimore, and they have decided to invest in me. And I advocate for that a lot, because the idea is that if you invest in people, the return is indefinite. We are not walking around with our hands out asking you for money. We want skills, resources, and knowledge. And You know, and while policy and law is important, and while reforming the Baltimore City Police Department is important, it takes a great deal of effort from the community to invest your time, your energy, your resources, your skills to individuals who need those things in order for us to become self-sustaining. So my challenge to individuals and community organizations and, you know, and agencies is to individually figure out how much time do you have in your day to invest back into a very vulnerable but ambitious population. And if we personally can begin to invest our time and skills and resources into people, then I think that the rate of recidivism will drop tremendously. And then it will open the doors to, you know, implementing laws and policies, because we have a collaboration of community people who, in most cases, are not connected to these movements. They work hard every day. They come home, they raise their children, and they're not really, mm-hmm. you know, politically involved. And through that mentorship, it will kind of start to connect them and get them to, you know, see individuals in a different light, as opposed to turning on the TV and listening to the radio about what these people look like. And
Right. John?
Well, you know, Lawrence said a trigger word for me earlier, and it was a state of emergency. And I agree with everything he said, but the truth is our entire community is in a state of emergency. It's like pick one. Pick where you want to choose a state of emergency. We've been there for a very long time now. It almost seems that the situation in Michigan, because it hit the media so hard, that's why it was declared a state of emergency. So, you know, I agree with everything Diamante, Nicole, and everyone is saying. As a organizer, I'm just sitting here thinking of how we can harness and bring all of these efforts together, because there's so many organizers, advocates. Here in Baltimore is probably the most I've ever seen in any city I've ever been to. But the truth is there's not enough collaboration. There's not enough honest collaboration to where people actually come together and say, listen, for example, what we're doing now, like, we understand that this opportunity for ex-felons to vote is huge. And so, you know, we're just passing the word along to each other. We're collaborating. You know, I think it's kind of one of the first times to where there's an honest collaboration between groups, and it's a beautiful thing. It feels good. Friendships are growing from it, and, like, people are starting to see each other as people and not necessarily activists, not necessarily, you know, it's we're all in this together, and, like, if we don't take advantage of this opportunity now, we may lose it. And, you know, the fire is hot. The iron is hot, and we have to strike now. So we have to encourage people to get out and vote early. We have to take advantage of, like, the mayoral forum that we just had. Like, here's an opportunity for people to speak directly to your issues and not really overlook them, because they're paying attention to you because you now have the power to vote.
So my question is, then, picking up on that we have this election coming up. People can register to vote between now and next Thursday. But then there's the general election coming up after April 26th through November, which is a whole long time to kind of do some work around these issues, around voting. So the question is, you have all these groups. Have your groups, Communities United. Mm-hmm. You've got No Boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Out for Justice.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Right to Housing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd name a whole bunch more that people don't get into the media as much.
And it's not just a Baltimore thing, Mark.
No.
This is a statewide.
It is. But what I'm trying to say is that, just looking at the city for just a minute, I mean, that when you look at all these groups that are doing work and organizing, and you were talking about the people getting to know each other, coming mm-hmm. together, but there's political power here, it seems, that is very disparate. You know, it's like not cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not together. Mm-hmm. Kind of, you're saying a state of emergency. So is that am I barking up the wrong tree here? Is there something that we need to think about in terms of what the lurking power from below, for want of a better term?
You're not barking up the wrong tree, Mark. One of the analogies I always, well, images I always give people is the image of Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King. And unfortunately, we always decide to choose one or the other. And both of them made it very clear that the only way they were going to be effective is if they had both. So we have a group of people that are all about the front line, protesting, in your face, bam. And then we have another group of people that are about behind closed doors, strategic planning, long-term goals, policy, how do we, you know, things like that. And we have to figure out how to bring it together, because if we continue to go the route that we're going down, it's not going to work. And it's not about everybody having the same mission. It's not about the red tape behind your funding and all of those things. It's about we have to find a common goal, and we have to understand each other's assets and where they come into play. And we're not taking enough time to take a moment to figure that out first before we move into action. And I think, you know, that's a mistake that we have made as advocates, activists, community members. And that's we're going to continue to make that mistake if we don't figure it out.
Yeah. We're going to see Lawrence. We'll hear about to say something.
Well, I mean, I think there's, you know, all of this is nuanced. All of this is multifaceted. So there's no silver bullet, no magic pill.
Right.
But, you know, I do think in conjunction with what we're saying about what community and activists and policy folk need to do, there's also the fact that for the past 105 years, we've structurally advantaged white L neighborhoods over black butterfly neighborhoods here in Baltimore City.
What does butterfly neighborhoods mean?
Black, disinvested red line black neighborhoods.
Yeah,
and when you look at the map of
the
segregation,
analogy, that's all. Right.
It looks like a butterfly.
Okay, gotcha.
And
right,
so,
right. Which is
know,
good.
What we have,
it's interesting.
It's right. It looks like a butterfly. Right. So, you know, Kendrick Lamar may say, you know, what we have is a situation in Baltimore where we pimp a butterfly. We pimp the black butterfly neighborhoods. And the perfect example of that is this Port Covington TIF. Mm-hmm. After an uprising, we're talking about building a new mini city in the White L for $535 million in TIF bonds.
The White L and the black butterfly. Is that what we're talking
about? The White L and the black butterfly.
I like
that's
that.
Right. So, but what kind of sense does it make, Mark, to talk about building a new city when the old one, the black communities we have in our city are falling apart? A vacant house literally fell on a man and killed him
right.
a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
We talked about lead poisoning. We're talking about the infrastructure, the schools that have lead. And we're talking about building a new city in the White L when the black communities are falling apart. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the underlying issue that I think John is getting at. Mm-hmm. Like, the state of emergency is pre-existing. It was before the uprising. But we're still continuing down a road of politics and, as usual, mm-hmm. of investing in the White L while disinvesting in the black butterfly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how does that change?
It changes.
Go ahead, Nicole. I'm going to go to John. Either way,
go ahead, John.
Well, you know, I think it. To me, it just seems like the elected officials and developers. And many people didn't really learn from the uprising. you know, there's no nice way to frame it. You know, how many more uprisings do you want to have? How many more do you want to have, Baltimore City? How many more do you want to have your elected officials who are selling the city to developers? Obviously, it seems that people are not driving up and down North Avenue enough. They're not visiting Cherry Hill enough. They're not connected to the community enough. Or either they don't care. Because the people that are in this studio, we see it all the time. And so there's no way I could come up here and see a harsh reality without speaking it. There's no way you can relate to the people in the community and go back to your office and not say, I need to do something about this. What has to happen, and I think we've already begun to cover it amongst all these organizations in the city, it doesn't matter if you don't like the way the person chews gum.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you don't like how they think. If you have the common goal, the same common goal, which many times could be described as broadly as justice for our people, then it's definitely time for us to come to the table and come together and put our resources together, no matter how little they are, no matter how large they are. If this is really about justice, then let's get on board, because the developers are on board. The developers have money. We don't have money, but we have people. The people have power. The only reason some of this stuff has been jump-started was due to the uprising, which hit national TV and embarrassed some of the elected officials, because what it did was uncover wounds that a lot of people didn't know about. Very similar to what took place when slavery hit national television and hit the world, and people looked at the United States and said, wow, I can't believe that's going on over there. And then soon slavery was abolished politically or policy wise. Right. But I work with kids every day in Renaissance High School, and now beginning on in a school on the east side. What Nicole was talking about, these mentoring programs. Everyone in our community has a place to fit in. We just have to find it. We're not asking you to devote your entire life to it, an hour or two a day. These are the things that we need. We have to begin to pull together a voting block. We have to begin to endorse and hold accountable the people that we endorse. And I could go on and on, but I'll stop there.
We have to take a short break and come right back for a break and come back and let Nicole jump in as well. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on where the city is going, your thoughts on what has to happen vis-a-vis this election, what you're looking for, what your thoughts are about where we need to go. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We are here with John Comer, co-director of Maryland Communities United, Diamante Brown, director of Out for Justice, Nicole Hansen, who's board president for Out for Justice, Dr. Lawrence Brown, public health consultant, assistant professor in public health here at Morgan State University, and you, 410-319-8888. A couple things came up during the break. One was Reality Bites tweeted in, the gangs united last April, make them meet once a month. You know, which is an interesting thought, and not crazy either, right? The 1619 Coalition and Luminous Intervention are gathering tomorrow night at the Tubman House, the property they took to open up for the kids, young people at 1618, and on the anniversary of Freddie Gray's death. They're going to do that tomorrow at 6 p.m. And I was thinking about that because in that particular neighborhood in Gilmore Homes, the gangs did make a truce not to have any violence or anything happen around Tubman House, so it would become a safe zone for young people to move in. Mm-hmm. So it's not ludicrous to think that organizations on the ground that really have that know the people can make those kind of things happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that the city doesn't kind of seem to me acknowledge, that there's power on the ground to make things happen.
And that goes to my next comment. What is required is that the directly impacted are in front of the conversation. Mm-hmm. They're in front of the issues. Mm-hmm. Individuals with a criminal record are the most untapped access in this city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
A few years ago, I co-authored a study on gang continuity. And it's published in the Black Journal for Criminal Justice. Actually, I'm probably getting the name wrong. But anyway, what we found, of course, and much of it was basic knowledge, right? The reason why there are gangs is because there's a lack of structure in our community. And so there's a lack of love, there's a lack of family. And so people join gangs because of that. And many times what comes out of that isn't always negative. It is structure, it is understanding, it is love. And so it shouldn't be far-fetched for brothers and sisters to be able to come together and for us to understand that they are able to see a system that has been against them. If they can, you know, they're able to identify it too, right? Mm-hmm. And so when there's something that is definitely positive there. Maybe they experienced it when they were kids and realized that it was a positive thing for them. Maybe they also know that, hey, the reason why I'm in a gang was because something like the Tubman House was not in existence when I was growing up. So the importance of this and for us to not have violence around this house is something that we definitely need to do and respect. So that also lends hope to the idea that if we continue to do things like this in our community and have more of these centers to help to bring our young kids along, that more gang members will open up to the idea that, hey, this is good. Mm-hmm. Because part of it is that all we see is in our communities is something that is meant to stifle us. You know, like it just seems that it's that way. I mean, you don't have to look far. You know, the housing situation, the fact that there are so many vacant housing around a housing project that has dilapidated conditions, and that you can go and take the boards down off of a house, and that it's inhabitable in a way to be able to have young kids there to mentor them. Just think about that. Gilmore Homes should be torn down. It's raggedy, right? It's a raggedy public housing project. But you can go across the street to a boarded up row home, and that is probably in a condition that's way better than the projects that the people are living in. But it's boarded up.
Right, and I think that's part of what you were writing in your article, right? In terms how you create a people's agenda for development and not just what we have.
But, I mean, what we also have, I mean, the context for creating a new development is understanding the context of segregation and forced displacement. This legacy of 105 years in Baltimore City, starting with racial zoning, then racially restricted covenants, then redlining, then you had segregated public housing. So we have all these policies that put black people into inferior neighborhoods, inferior housing, inferior transportation in their neighborhoods. And we have not dismantled those systems.
Inferior schools.
Right. And that's the thing, number one. Even though we have black leadership in place, what Davon Love said on Melissa Harris Perry is what we have is the sophistication of white supremacy. We have mm-hmm. white supremacy right. in black face. Mm-hmm. We have black leaders that are funded by white dollars mm-hmm. who are primarily coming from corporate developers. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation that we have here in Baltimore. We have people that are maintaining hyper-segregation and forced displacement. Until we have a new politics, and I really believe that means getting rid of the Democrats. We need whether it's the Greens or the Ujima Party, mm-hmm. the Democrats have failed us miserably, mm-hmm. and I don't think that they're the source of the salvation. Aside from a wonderful legislator like Delegate Carter, you know, most Democrats in this city are receiving funds from the FOP. I mean, the same people that said that we look like a lynch mob last year, the same people that attacked a 17-year-old Michaela Gilliam Price on Twitter, mm-hmm. and we're supposed to believe that if you're receiving funding from them that you're acting in the best interest of the black community. No. I don't think that can be the way anymore. We need a new politics. The Democrats got us into this mess. They do not have the vision for getting us out of this mess. And I'm sorry, but I think that's just the truth.
I agree wholeheartedly with Lawrence and Nicole. One, what Nicole said was the directly impacted must be in the forefront. We can have as many scholars, experts, people that did studies that we want to have. But until we get the people that are directly impacted by these issues to the table, mm-hmm. nothing is going to happen.
That's in our best interest anyway.
Exactly. Right. Like, you know, because what ends up happening is as much as we think that we're fighting the good fight, a lot of people that are so-called advocates or activists, and not so-called, they are, but they also go back to a comfortable
environment.
You know, mm-hmm. you know, when you, one of the things that Grace Lee Boggs, which she was a Chinese American black activist. She was a black activist. Exactly.
They were revolutionaries together, right?
And one of the things that she argues is that you have to start where you are. I live on 30th Street in Fenwick. I don't go home to a comfortable environment. The dope boy's right outside right now. Trash is on the ground. A corner store is on Hartford and Helen that we need to get down. It's several things going on right there. However, That is where we need to start. How do we organize my community? How do we switch that corner store from selling everything that we know is bad for us to selling something that's good? How do we empower the people to not want to throw the black bags on the trash? We have to start with us. We have to invest in ourselves. And I know all of the isms that people like to bring up and use it as an excuse as to why we can't do that. But if we continue to use those isms as an excuse as to why we can't do that, then it won't get done. Because like Lauren said, government isn't going to do it. The Democrats aren't going to do it. Because like I said, at the end of the day, they go home to a comfortable way of living and they don't have to worry about it. We need the people that when they go home, they have to worry about the issues that we are talking about.
So let me open the phones here. I mean, that's a very powerful statement you just made that just came out from all of you here. That I think that, but that's the surge from the bottom up is what has to happen in the city.
Yeah. How do you know what we want unless you ask us?
Unless you take it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the folks in Gilmore Homes took Tubman House and opened it up.
Just take it.
Right? So let me open
Asking.
You're right. Without asking.
Right.
Let me open the phones here and then also read this tweet that came in. It's interesting for us to wrestle with this tweet that came in. But let me go to the phones first. 410-319-8888. Bill, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, Mark. Again, this is such a good program. I think, you know, all the guests have said some very good things. My only disagreement was the last thing was when the brother said that the Democrats got us in 2 days and they're not going to get us out on this. I think that earlier y'all said the solution. The solution is that we had to be able to come together collectively as a people to put our agenda forward. So, I mean, regardless of if it's a Democrat in, Republican in, a Green Party is in, then we got the agenda that we pushing, but we're uniting on. The problem is that we're not united enough to push our issues. Let me just use one example, you know, and I hope I don't offend nobody. But it's like the gay movement. You know, the gay movement got all these laws passed now because they was united and they had some power because of the unity. So until we get that kind of unity within our community, then it's not going to make no difference what party is in because they're still going to get money from people that got money until we change that process so that the people is in control opposed to the politicians being in control.
Bill, thanks so much for that call. Before we go to T in Columbia, let me read this tweet from Paul. What Paul Beller wrote said, infrastructure costs are prohibitive, with about six exclamation points. Let me turn to you, Lawrence, to jump in this first, because, I mean, this is one of your areas. Mm-hmm. This is one of the questions. How do you rebuild a city?
It's simple.
Right?
It's simple.
Simple. Go ahead. I'm going to hear simple.
Baltimore reparations. We need local reparations for black disinvested redlined communities.
There you go.
That's what you do. You do the same thing that President Jack Young is trying to do with the youth thing. He's trying to allocate 3% of the budget for youth spending and lock it in. Well, let's do that with 5 or 10% of the Baltimore budget. If you do it at 10%, right now that's approximately $250 million at 10%. So you take $250 million or more, and for the next 30 years, you send it directly to the people that are impacted in these redlined, disinvested neighborhoods. You select a council of 15, elect a council of 15 from these neighborhoods, and let them choose the priorities for that community. Let them decide how to redevelop those neighborhoods. Let them decide how to fix the schools, fix the transportation, fix whatever issues they see in their community. Reparations, because Baltimore is ground zero. It is the home, the origin of American segregation. Therefore, Baltimore City must be involved in reparations to black communities. And then you can have, from the bottom up, this process where people are in control of their own lives and black communities are able to heal and be made whole.
Mm-hmm. That's an answer.
Mm-hmm. A great answer.
And I think that the shift in this conversation has to take place that way, whether it's how we spend the bond money, where it goes, and things like Port Covington, if they want to start these manufacturing, the jobs have to come here.
Right.
They can't go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But that TIF is $500 million for a billionaire company is a little hard to swallow for many people in this community, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get another phone call here, 410-319-8888. This is T in Columbia, you're on the air.
Nicole, I'm actually just running out to Whole Foods to grab some food and heading back to work, which is in Skaggsville. But definitely Baltimore Rear, Baltimore Bread, and a alumni of Morgan State. So definitely have a heart for the city. Listening to your callers, and I'm in agreement that both political parties have absolutely failed African Americans. But in addition to that, we have to call our leadership, so-called leadership, into on the carpet. Because as we said, and it's just sort of the way that they function with African Americans, which is in order for you to elevate financially, you basically have to disavow black causes, mm-hmm. is what I feel that it happens often, mm-hmm. not just in politics, but just in general. And so I think that, as the gentleman said, I think that reparations is an excellent comment, but I think that we attack not just from the bottom, but we attack in all areas. Mm-hmm. We ask for and demand, representation and accommodation in all areas, not just economically, but in business. You want to fix the schools. If you can find money, all this money to allocate for a red line in PG County or Silver Spring or Bethesda for others, you can allocate money for Baltimore City and other places that are affected, you know, for black people. So my comment is not just that we hit it in one area. We can't afford it. We're hemorrhaging. We have to run in all areas, politically, economically, financially. We got to get to the schools. We got to help the babies. And they know. They know it. They knew exactly what they were doing when they closed the rec centers. They knew what they were doing. They knew that it would further create dysfunction in our community. So we have to go back to the table. We have to come together as a unit and figure out exactly what we want. And, you know, top five, top ten, whatever it is, and we have to get to it. But I agree, the political parties have failed us miserably. That's my comment. Thanks.
T, thanks so much for listening and calling in. Appreciate the thoughts.
Can I add to what that caller said?
Demonte, go ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to say that she's right. And I was thinking earlier that one of the things we have to get more comfortable with saying is black. Every time we talk about stuff, we want to talk about people of color, disenfranchised communities. We have all of these code words. If we keep clumping everything together, we're never going to get to the issue. It is okay to say we need to deal with black neighborhoods.
Yes.
For example, the trash cans. Every neighborhood and every resident in Baltimore City does not need to be bought a trash can. That is not justice. That is equality. The black neighborhoods that are dirty and downtrodden, those are the neighborhoods that needed the trash can. So instead of having one, maybe we could have had two. We have to stop doing that, and we have to be unapologetic about saying black. We need to work on this issue for black people. We need to do this for black people. We don't have a problem when it's Hispanic people. We don't have a problem saying when it's Asian or Jewish people, but somehow, and when it's anytime it's something and we want to just empower black people or fix black communities, people almost force us to be all inclusive, because if we're not all inclusive, somehow we're a threat. That's the first thing. And secondly, I want to say I want people to be clear about how recreational centers got closed. It wasn't a they, it was a we. That question was on the ballot.
Right.
I remember it. It asked us, can we put this much money into keeping recreation centers open? But because only 20% of the people went to the polls, mm-hmm. and voted, or a lot of them went and only voted on mayor or city council or whatever they thought was popular enough to vote on, that's why recreation centers was closed. It wasn't a they, it's a we, and we have to understand the process, because if we don't understand the process, things like that will continue to happen and we will not hold ourselves accountable for it. We did that.
Right. Well, you know, Mark, like, you know that Communities United, we pretty much have people from the community. We go out and knock on doors and recruit people from McCullough Homes, Gilmore Homes, and we've been in a bunch of other places. You know, I agree with much everyone with much of what everyone has said, but we have to definitely follow up with what we what we preach. Like, we have to educate. We just can't sit here and say we're going to educate the community and not actually reach out and try to recruit new people in the room and actually educate them on what's taking place. Because if we understand what's going on, we also know that the system of oppression was meant to knock us off of our rocker, to where we won't look at voting as a power, where we won't look at recreation centers as something that we need, because it just seems that we have been spent around so many times and we're still trying to regain our focus, but we're still, you know, we're still dizzy. So it definitely takes organizers, no matter where they're from, as long as they have the right idea of going into the community and have the same idea of justice, to come in and educate the people. Now, myself, I live in Lower Park Heights. I also have lived in on East Fayette and Milton Avenue, so I definitely kind of know what's going on as well. But I definitely agree with the idea that we have to have the people up front from the community speaking for themselves, but we also have to understand that there's guidance that also needs to take place. There's reinstilling, like, a belief in our community that we can do it, not belief in the system, because I could understand the loss of belief in the system, but the belief in ourselves to actually come together, push forward, and move something. And sometimes I think that when we make small achievements, we don't realize how big they are, right? Right. Like, so the fact that we are passing certain policy that's in favor of us, even some of the community members that we may take down to Annapolis and have them to testify, I don't really think they internalize how large it is for them to be able to do that. But we just have to, it's small things we have to pay attention to and make sure that the people from our communities understand, like, you did this. Like, it wasn't just a bus ride down there and you showing up. Like, you really did this, and your story impacted the elected officials. The reason why the media came around was because you showed up in droves. And so there's so much that we have to work on psychologically, policy-wise.
So let me – I have a quick question here. The tweet coming in for you, Lawrence. I want to have a question for Nicole. We have 5 minutes left, so let me see if I can get these things out real fast. Motosurf just tweeted in, lead poisoning in Maryland is down 95% since 2000, according to the CDC. What do you say?
That's a terrible statistic.
It's a very
– because there's no safe level of lead poison, and what that statistic refers to is the amount of that has dropped over the lead limit in Maryland. So now I believe the lead limit in Maryland is like 10 or 5 micrograms per deciliter. But if you're at 4 or 9 or 8 or 3, you're still lead poison, and lead still has a damaging impact on the brain. So we need to throw that statistic out of the window. All right, that's the first thing we need to do in the lead fight, because if you have a 2 microgram per deciliter of lead in your blood, you are being damaged by lead. And so we need to throw that statistic out of the window. It is false and misleading. Black children are still being lead poisoned, and we just can't say Black Lives Matter. We also have to say Black Neighborhoods Matter.
Right. And we have only a couple minutes left, so we go around really quickly. Does it make a difference who wins this election to you?
It does make a difference who wins this election, not just for me, but for all of Baltimore. These are the people that we choose to run our government, to pass laws that directly impact us. So it makes a great difference. Will it stop the work that we're doing? No. We will continue to do great work. We will continue to educate individuals on the legislative process, not just asking them to vote, but letting them know how important voting is, and voter education and voting mobilization. Even after November, we have to continue to mobilize people to come out and register to vote. You know, in closing, for me, people have to invest in people. If you are a corporation, you need to make sure that you're investing in the individuals who live in those communities, because that will only make your business thrive. If you're in an organization who are heading these programs, it is important to have the directly impacted leading, or quite frankly, at the table of your program. And so, you know, I'll close with just saying we have a lot of work ahead of us. I think the organizations in Baltimore are doing great work. We're coming together. We're collaborating. One of the good things that I got out of Freddie Gray is that I was able to connect with groups and people and individuals across Baltimore who were doing some of the same work that I was doing. I had never met them before. And so we're on the right track.
We got like a minute and a half left, but this is I think, been a very dynamic conversation, and I do appreciate everybody coming into this studio today and having this conversation here. We need more of these conversations to push this ahead, and I think that the organizations you represent, Community United, the organizing work you're doing is critically important now for justice as a project led by people who are returning citizens and building a new movement is really important. You don't get enough play, but we're going to commit the Mark Steiner Show to give Out for Justice lots of play on this program.
Thank you,
Mark. Thank you, Mark.
Because you all deserve it.
And, a woman-led organization like that.
And that, too.
You know, and
because
I also
want
to— women
have records, too.
I also want to insert that Communities United is much woman-led because most of our members are women. So big shout-out to Black women.
Yeah.
And Lawrence Brown, for all the organizing and the work you do, because one of the things you do here is the research you do fuels the building of a movement because you give it the substance to fight about and the facts to fight around with. So I think that's really critically important. So Anthony, others who called in from Hartford County, the places, I'm sorry we couldn't get to all your calls, but we'll have this conversation continuing. And I appreciate all the people on the show, Dr. Lawrence Brown, School of Public Health here at Morgan State University, Diamante Brown, who's Executive Director of Out for Justice, Nicole Hansen, who is their Board President, John Comer, who is Co-Director of Maryland Community United. Thank the four of you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's been the most original and different local news roundup we've had in a long time. We need more of this. Thank you so much. And thank you all for tuning in and calling in and making the show what it is. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns are Sienna Grease, Manifa Wilson, Morgan Barber, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast, Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org. Or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.